Hello, and welcome to Cricket in England through five matches. In this series of podcasts, we'll be examining aspects of English culture, society and history in the early 20th century. And in each episode, we'll be doing so by looking at a single cricket match. Last month, we visited Lords in 1900 for the Gentlemen vs. Players match and a look at the cricketing class system. This time, in episode 2, we return to the home of cricket, but for a county championship match. Middlesex versus Kent in the summer of 1914. A fixture played as the drumbeat of war grew louder and louder.
There's a breathless hush in the close tonight. 10 to make and the match to win. A bumping pitch and a blinding light. An hour to play. And the last man in. And it's not for the sake of a ribboned coat, or the selfish hope of a season's fame, but his captain's hand on his shoulder smote. Play up, and play the game. The sand of the desert is sodden red, red with the wreck of the square that broke. The Gatling's jammed and the colonel dead, and the regiment blind with dust and smoke. The river of death has brimmed its banks, and England's far, and honour a name. But the voice of a schoolboy rallies the ranks. Play up, and play the game.
Lords, Friday, 28th of August, 1914. Middlesex versus Kent, day two. Colin Charlie Blythe stood at the end of his run, waiting for Middlesex's stand-in captain, Leslie Kidd, to settle in his crease. The home side were establishing a healthy second innings lead, and the partnership between Kidd and George Hebden, which had quickly passed 50 runs, would have begun to seriously irritate. If Kent were to turn this around, wickets needed to fall quickly. With Kidd ready, Blythe began his approach. A shuffle of the feet, and then a hop before the final approach and a side-on delivery which allowed the ball to be hidden from the batsman until the moment his left arm finally swung into view. The ball pitched, turned, and evading bat thudded into the Middlesex man's pad. An appeal rang out, and all eyes turned to the umpire, who raised his finger to send Kidd on his way. At 35 years of age, and still at the peak of his cricketing powers, no one could have foreseen that it would be Charlie Blythe's last wicket in first-class cricket. Any person at Lord's that day enjoying the contest between Middlesex and Kent, and who had shelled out a halfpenny for a copy of that morning's Daily Mail, would have eventually turned the page of their newspaper and seen a photograph taken at the match the day before. This picture was not of the game itself, but of spectators gathered in front of what appears to be the old Lord's Tavern. With an estimated 2,000 people in attendance on the first day of the game, any photographer wanting to capture a well-populated part of the ground had plenty to choose from. He may have selected this particular grouping because, with the exception of one child whose gender is unclear, it was universally male. It may also have been because a number of those in his sights, particularly on the front row, were young. Young and male, just the ticket for this particular assignment. The men in this photograph, clad in suits and ties, flat caps and boaters, sit mostly with hands clasped or arms folded and stare passively, some at the camera, others straight ahead, presumably at the game. Perhaps a shout to keep still for the shot had held them in pose. There are some exceptions. A few look away. One tilts his head down so that his hat obscures all but a fine moustache. A heavily bearded man standing behind the seats near the camera appears the oldest of the group. One serious-looking younger man, two rows in front of him, sports a black armband in memory, perhaps, of a recently deceased relative. In contrast, two others further along the front row appear to observe the cameraman with amusement. The reason the Daily Mail's photographer was more interested in the crowd than the cricket was clear. This was no celebration of Middlesex's final game of the season. It was not designed to mark the closing of the county season at Lord's. Its purpose was to shame and to intimidate. Headlined Cricket Enthusiast During the War, the photograph was supplemented with a brief explanation from the paper. It said, "People are anxious to see the type of men who look on in the cricket field while the manhood of Europe is in the battlefield. This photograph is a section of the crowd at the Middlesex versus Kent match at Lord's yesterday." Ominously, it threatened that further selections will be published. The call to arms was causing tensions at home, and it seemed that cricket was in the firing line.
Then he shouted to them there, "It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go."
On August 4th, 1914, Parliament formally declared war on Germany. Tensions had been building between the great powers for some time, but came to a head for the British government over the German threat to the neutrality of Belgium, whom Britain had treaty obligations towards. Within an already escalating context of conflict, Austro-Hungary had declared war on Serbia, leading to the mobilisation of Russian forces, which, in turn, had led to states of war existing between Germany and Russia and Germany and France. On August the 3rd, the British government sent an ultimatum to Germany, demanding guarantees of Belgian security. The next day, German troops entered Belgian territory, and Britain entered the war. The day after the declaration of war, Field Marshal Lord Kitchener, born Horatio Herbert Kitchener, was appointed Secretary of State for War. Kitchener, who had made his reputation on the battlefields of Sudan and South Africa, did not accept that this war was likely to be won quickly, and accurately predicted that the existing British expeditionary force would be far too small for the job ahead. To remedy this, Kitchener declared that not only would the part-time territorial forces be employed in active overseas service, but a series of new armies would be created, and almost immediately a call for volunteers was issued. By August 6th, a large box ran in many national newspapers declaring, "Your king and country need you." It asked all young, unmarried men to rally round the flag and enlist in the ranks of her army. The initial age range was set between 18 and 30. The overall impression given by newspapers and newsreels of the response to the call to enlistment was one of a great early success, with nearly 500,000 men committing themselves to armed service between August the 4th and September the 12th, 1914. However, these images and figures obscure two pertinent facts. The first was that in the initial 2 weeks following the declaration of war, enlistment was slow relative to later weeks, especially in rural areas, where recruitment organisations were not so quick to establish themselves. The second was that Kitchener was aware that, even when enlistment picked up by early September, his armies were still well short of the numbers needed to fight the necessary scale of battle that was becoming apparent. As Kitchener continued to lead the effort to swell the ranks of his new armies, questions began to swirl around the cricketing world as to what its responsibilities were in regard to those young men who played and watched the game. Should indeed the game continue at all, when so many of those who participated could be employed in the service of their country? Many of the cricketers who made an early decision to forgo the county cricket field and commit themselves to the army were drawn from the ranks of the amateurs. To some extent, this fitted into a familiar pattern. Most amateurs of the game were quite used to declaring themselves available or unavailable for selection as circumstances allowed, whereas professionals, under contract with their county and reliant on wages to support their families, were expected to be at the disposal of their employers. There was also a cultural factor which linked many of the amateurs of the game to expectations of military service via the schools of their youth. It was quite common for the public schoolboy's choice of career path to wind its way via the officer corps of His or Her Majesty's Army. Almost 100 years before, it had been said that the Duke of Wellington had claimed that the Battle of Waterloo had been won on the playing fields of Eton. While the quotation is likely apocryphal, the extent to which it took hold in the popular imagination was not. The link between the training of a superior soldier and the playing of sports, particularly cricket, rugby or rowing, was notable and explicit in folklore of the British aristocracy. In 1898, on the eve of the Boer War, Henry Newbolt made this link in his poem Vitae Lampada, with which we began this episode. The language of cricket, already prevalent in wider popular use, penetrated discussion of war. Running a picture piece on captured enemy soldiers in 1914, the Daily Mirror assured its readers that the prisoners will be treated with every kindness and consideration. As a nation of sportsmen, we always play the game according to rules, be it war or cricket. The call to arms also fed into a late Victorian notion of muscular Christianity, where, according to Keith Sandiford, godliness and manliness, spiritual perfection and physical power became inextricably woven. This link between physicality and moral worth was particularly prevalent in public schools during the 19th century, and accordingly, it was no coincidence that cricket had become an essential part of the public school curriculum by the 1860s. In August of 1914, then, it was a socially natural step for many, though certainly not all, young amateur cricketers, not that long from having graced the playing fields of Eton, Harrow, Winchester or elsewhere, to decide that the time to fulfil their duty as an officer had arrived. For some, such as Middlesex's usual captain Pelham Warner, the call to arms, which was the cause of his absence from the side in August of 1914, was not a novelty, but a continuation of service which had begun some years before in the territorials. Professional cricketers were by no means immune to the call to war, but they also had their duty to their county employers, and with the season drawing to a close, most clearly decided to see out the remaining matches before making any such decision. But in having to decide whether to leave their current employment to heed Kitchener's appeal, these men were no different to their friends and neighbours working in the factories, mines and shops. On the one hand, patriotic zeal and a sense of adventure appealed to some to take up military colours immediately. On the other, for most working and middle-class men, the call to arms was an unfamiliar one, the reasons for war unclear, and the proximity of the battle to them and their families remote. There was also a financial consideration. Pay for the lowest ranks of soldiers was small compared to that which most workers received, only slightly above that of an agricultural labourer. And even many unmarried men of enlistment age had responsibilities to help support the family home. As August wore on, the public were bombarded with messages urging the young menfolk to answer the call. The Daily Mirror, amongst many others, regularly presented features imploring its readers to enlist. On August 27th, the first day of the match at Lord's, it ran a full-page spread headed by a large picture of Lord Kitchener with a banner, "Your King and Country Need You, Join the Army Today," and went further when it challenged that the death of a brave man is worth more to the world and a woman than the life of a coward. On the same morning, when the Middlesex and Kent players met at Lord's, they would have been greeted by the Daily Express's broad headline, "Britain's greatest need is men to fight her battles," and a lead article which not only called on men to do their duty, but advised its female readers to make patriotism a test of their affection. Similar calls for women to shame their men into serving ran across the popular press. The sporting community were an obvious target for recruitment efforts, given the assumed prevalence of young, fit men in their ranks, and sporting authorities were keen to show that they were playing an active role in the war effort. The Football Association called on all its clubs to place grounds at the disposal of local military units between matches, and on game day to allow well-known figures to appeal to the crowd for eligible men to enlist at recruitment centres set up nearby. Proposals were put forward in the press for special footballers' units to be created to encourage players to enlist. Other sports were equally as keen to show their spirit. Boxing benefits for the Prince of Wales War Relief Fund were held, and venues such as London's Premierland boasted of the numbers of boxers who had enlisted after appeals at their tournaments. Other appeals to sportsmen and spectators were frequently made with an accusatory tone. In early September, The Sportsman ran a cartoon depicting a short, flat-capped, smoking football fan holding on to a muscular footballer, who in turn looks indecisively as he is beckoned by a departing soldier. The caption ran, the idol, and the ideal. Letters and comment in the press often berated those who did not offer their service. One missive to The Sportsman on August the 29th branded bachelor amateur cricketers who had not signed up as fools or cowards. We have already mentioned the ominous Daily Mail photograph from Lords. This idea of leisure as the hiding place of the reluctant servicemen also extended beyond sport to other forms of entertainment, prompting one theatre lover to express his dismay at such attitudes to the Daily Mirror, proclaiming that the closing of all places of entertainment would spell absolute destitution to tens of thousands of the theatrical profession, both men and women and the children dependent upon them. Cricketers themselves were by no means immune from public pressure. On August 17th, five Middlesex professionals playing in a match against Nottinghamshire received a letter from one irate member of the public. Scrawled in red ink across all angles of the page, the angry communication accused the men of rank cowardice and funk for not having gone to the service of their country. While The Sportsman was happy to give space to those with grievances towards sporting participants and spectators, The Sporting Life was keener to launch the case for the defence. Stressing the paper's support for recruitment efforts among the sportsmen of Britain, it nevertheless decried the crank and the panicmonger, the purveyors of cheap sneers, and their senseless outcry against sport, asking why it was so wrong for the men who would, through age or injury, be remaining at home, to enjoy an hour or two of recreation in the spirit of keeping on. Although soon after the declaration of war, the MCC had claimed that no good purpose can be served at the moment by cancelling matches, the cricketing authorities were keen to make it clear that they were doing their best to encourage all cricketers of enlisting age to do their duty. Lord Alverstone, president of Surrey County Cricket Club, wrote from his sickbed to earnestly appeal to all amateurs and professionals to show they are not behindhand in patriotism and love of their country. Hampshire's J.C. Moberly and Russell Bencraft, president and chairman of the committee respectively, wrote to several newspapers defending their players. While they insisted that it was right the season should continue in the interests of their professionals, a most deserving class, they pointed out that 10 amateurs who have played for Hampshire this season are either at the front or have volunteered and been accepted for service, that all the professionals have volunteered for home service, thus proving that, amongst their men, there has been no lack of loyalty towards the pressing needs of the Empire. The leading cricketers of the day also wanted to show their loyalty towards the war effort. A long list of notables, including W.G. Grace, Jack Hobbs, Frank Woolley, Gilbert Jessop, Johnny Douglas, and others, put their names behind an appeal to the cricket-loving public for donations to the Prince of Wales National Relief Fund, established to help the families of serving men and those suffering from industrial distress. Yet, despite the efforts of the sporting community to demonstrate their commitment to the war effort, the image of young men enjoying sport rather than marching to battle was too much for some, and calls for the cessation of sporting contests continued to be heard. The continuation of the county cricket season roused none other than W.G. Grace from his retirement for one last salvo. On August 27, 1914, The Sportsman published a letter from the champion where he noted that while many cricketers had already heeded the call to arms, there were others that did not seem to realise that they will have to serve. "I think," he proclaimed, "the time has arrived when the county cricket season should be closed, for it is not fitting that able-bodied men should play day after day and pleasure-seekers look on," before concluding that he should like to see all first-class cricketers of suitable age, etc., set a good example and come to the help of their country without delay in its hour of need. The response to this clarion call, in the pages of the Sportsman at least, was not universally in agreement. 2 days later, the Wanderer used his column to take issue with Grace's view, asserting that there was a contradiction in that, on one hand, we are enjoined to carry on the business and work of the country as far as possible. On the other, that watching a match is a form of relieving the mind from the tension of the war that ought to be tabooed. Pointing out that many of Grace's pleasure seekers were themselves in military uniform, he asked, "Where is the harm?" On August 31st, regular columnist, an old county player, joined the debate, arguing that one could not blame the professional players, as, while the counties continued to agree to matches, they had no option but to go on serving their employers, and that there is not a single first-class cricketer today unready to do something serviceable, but he thought it unfair that they all ought to join the army. He contended that 8 out of 10 professional cricketers would, in any event, likely fall out of the qualification for army service. Qualified amateurs, he conceded, should, of course, go. W.G. Grace was obviously stung by some of the criticisms sent his way, and a further salvo from the grand old man of cricket appeared in the pages of the Sportsman on September the 2nd. His previous letter, he said somewhat grumpily, had clearly been misunderstood by a few people, some of whom think more of the county championship than of their country's dire need. Grace seemed to backtrack somewhat from his previous position when he claimed that he had no problem with games being played and watched by those who were unfit or too old for military service, but exclaimed that it was a disgrace at such times for any able-bodied man of suitable age and good health to be wasting his time in playing or watching games. He had not been the first notable figure from within the game to come to this conclusion. Middlesex's captain, Pelham Warner, had cabled the influential Lord Harris on August the 6th, suggesting the cancellation of all remaining fixtures. Harris took the proposal to his own county of Kent, where it was quickly rebuffed on the grounds that the Kent Committee disliked the idea of their employees having to suffer. Pressure continued to be placed on the county, prompting Lord Harris to initiate a public response from the committee, arguing that they were simply responding to the government's request that people should endeavour, as far as possible, to live our normal lives. The committee were clearly not as one, however, as after an exchange of letters with Lord Harris over the issue, the Honourable Major J.S.R. Tufton resigned. As pressure grew on the counties, and players began to respond to Lord Kitchener's appeals, a premature end to the season began to take on an air of inevitability, even to those who urged it towards completion. The question started to become one of when, rather than if. Would the curtain fall if Surrey secured the title at Sussex in their match scheduled to begin on September the 3rd? Would Yorkshire's fixtures at the Scarborough Carnival, planned for the same week, survive, leaving only Surrey's final fixture and a first-class match between an MCC South African touring side and Lord Lonsborough's 11 unplayed? In the end, the close came suddenly. On September the 2nd, at Hove, when Herbert Wilson and George Hurst, the captains of Sussex and Yorkshire, shook hands on a drawn game, it was to be the last county cricketing action for over 4 years. In early September, the rugby union authorities had come to the same conclusion and declared that it was no time for rugby football, that young and active sportsmen should play the game by serving their country in a military capacity. Their clubs were instructed to cancel all their international and county matches, and, rather optimistically, said that those fixtures should stand in the next season. They also urged all rugby players to immediately enlist and announce that they were approaching the War Office about the possibility of a rugby footballers' corps. Such a sacrificial attitude was not shared across all sports, however. The association football authorities decided to continue their season. After meeting to consider the matter, the Football Association urged eligible players to enlist, but decided that a suspension of the season would be mischievous rather than good. The management committee of the Football League concurred, declaring that their competition should continue in order to help the nation bear its sorrow, relieve the oppression of continuous strain, and save the people at home from panic and depression. The 1914-15 football season was played out in full, Everton finishing as champions, though once completed, the Football League would follow the lead of rugby and cricket and not return until 1919. Local football associations took their own decisions, and many made a much earlier choice to suspend competition. That horse racing continued to entertain the public was in no little part due to royal intervention. None other than George V made it clear that he wished the sport of kings to continue. Compromises were necessary, as many prominent racecourses were commandeered by the War Office, but racing would keep going throughout the duration of the conflict. Cricket was not to be completely moribund for the duration, however. The leagues were not in a unanimous agreement with the counties over the need to put away bat and ball for the duration of the war. Several, including the important Lancashire League, not only saw their season to a full conclusion, but would continue to schedule matches the next year and thereafter. Lords, Thursday, 27th of August, 1914. Middlesex versus Kent, Day 1. The coin fell Middlesex's way, yet their skipper, Leslie Kidd, did not respond immediately. He was no novice at captaincy, having been asked on several occasions to assume the role when Middlesex's usual leader, that stalwart of the game, Pelham Warner, was absent. But this may have been his trickiest call yet. The previous 2 days had seen considerable rain in London, and with showers having passed overhead already that morning, the pitch would have been damp at best. It was also a very humid morning, and that combination promised assistance for the bowlers in swing, turn and break. However, while the clouds overhead might help the ball move in the air, the most pressing issue was when they would lift. If the sun were to make its way through and turn the damp pitch sticky, the three-pronged Kent attack of Blythe, Woolley and Freeman could become unplayable. The cloud cover looked set in for the immediate future, however, and so, after quite some hesitation, Kidd decided to trust his batsmen and make use of the freshly rolled surface before a change in overhead conditions could work any mischief. A shake of the hands with Kent's captain, Lionel Troughton, and the Middlesex skipper headed back to the Lord's Pavilion to tell his openers to pad up. Though late in the season, this match still had meaning in terms of the destination of the county championship. Kent, the reigning champions from 1916, were out of the running and simply enjoying the last few weeks before their title would be passed along. Middlesex's championship ambitions, however, were still alive. Surrey, sitting in first place, were the clear favourites, but with 3 games still outstanding, if they were to stumble, their London rivals had the opportunity to take the title. That is, if they could first defeat this very good Kent team at Lord's. Middlesex's Frank Tarrant and Harry Lee strode to the middle to begin the home side innings and to find out what life the damp pitch was going to offer their opponents. The situation was far from ideal. Taking your guard on a wet one in overcast, humid conditions was challenging enough. But to do so against the reigning county champions, whose opening bowlers already had over 280 scalps that season between them, and included the leading wicket-taker in first-class cricket, was akin to staring down the barrel. With August centuries under each of their belts, however, the Middlesex openers were no slouches, although they were a contrast of levels of experience. Originally a bowler, Australian Frank Tarrant had begun his first-class career in 1899 with his native Victoria, but struggled to make much of an impact. It would only be when he tried his luck in England, first for the MCC, and then, after qualification for the county in 1905, as a professional with Middlesex, that his all-round talent began to show. Tarrant's batting came on in leaps and bounds, and he soon became a fixture at the top of the order, and frequently an opening bowler as well. By 1914, he had scored just shy of 15,000 first-class runs, including 27 centuries. He eventually finished his career in 1933, by which time he had racked nearly 18,000 runs and over 1,500 wickets, as well as the double of 1,000 runs and 100 wickets in a season 8 times. Despite this, and despite being named one of Wisden's Cricketers of the Year in 1908, Tarrant was to remain uncapped in international cricket. His partner, Harry Lee, would go on to international recognition, albeit a solitary England cap, by accident, according to his memoirs. But in 1914, he was a relative novice in county cricket. It was true that he had joined the Lords ground staff in 1906 and made his Middlesex debut in 1911, but opportunities in the side had been limited, and when they came, he usually found himself batting very low down the order. Consequently, Lee had found it difficult to make any sort of impact on the Middlesex committee men, his few notable performances coming more of his off-breaks and slow medium pace deliveries than with the bat. By the end of the 1913 season, he had managed only 12 appearances, accrued just 106 total runs and taken 9 wickets. 1914 had got off to a similarly unpromising start, notching just 2 county championship appearances and 2 university games before August, when Lord Kitchener's call to the recruiting offices affected so many Middlesex amateurs that all available hands were needed to produce a competitive 11. With Frank Tarrant's regular partner, William Robertson, one of those missing, the job of opening the innings was offered to Lee. After a couple of respectable scores against Yorkshire and Lancashire, Harry Lee made his first big un at Lord's against Nottinghamshire, scoring 139 second-inning runs and sharing a stand of 183 with the brilliant Patsy Hendren. The dark clouds that had gathered over Europe would see his new career as an opener rudely interrupted. But after spending the later war years coaching and playing in India at the invitation of his opening partner Frank Tarrant, Harry returned to Middlesex colours in 1919 and remained a loyal servant of the county right up until 1934. While more expansive colleagues such as Hearn or Hendren would often take the headlines, Lee scored his runs in a more gritty style. Gritty, patient, but effective. And by the time his Middlesex days ended, he had contributed over 20,000 first-class runs for the county, including 38 centuries, and he passed 1,000 runs in a season 13 times. On this overcast Lord's morning, Harry Lee, reasonably new to the opener's berth, would have watched carefully as Tarrant faced up to Woolley for the first over, keen to see what dangers the damp pitch held. It soon became clear that while not quite a sticky wicket, it was slow and offered turn, and the odd ball leapt awkwardly. Still, a vigilant Frank Tarrant saw off the first 6 balls with little alarm, leaving Harry Lee to face Bligh from the other end. Lee settled into his familiar low, crouched stance, his body almost bent to 90 degrees, and waited for Bligh to work his magic. The first few deliveries were dealt with, but then Harry went after one. It took the edge of the bat, and with no mistake from wicketkeeper Fred Hoish, the umpire's finger was up. History does not preserve whether the ball spat from the surface, bounced excessively, or if Harry had just misread the line. Whatever the truth, he was on his way for a duck, leaving the distinct impression that his captain's decision to bat may have been hasty. If there was a middle order for a tricky situation, however, it was Middlesex's, with J.W. Hearn and Patsy Hendren due in at 3 and 4, the home team had 2 players who would go on to imprint their name on their county's record books. J.W. Hearn, known as Young Jack to distinguish him from the other Hearn, J.T., in the Middlesex squad, was one of those players who, while prolific for his county, was never able to reach his full potential at international level. A classy, intelligent all-rounder and fine fielder, Jack joined the Lords ground staff at the tender age of 15, and only 3 years later made his county debut. With the bat, he played classically straight, but was able to cut, drive through the covers, or play through the onside with ease. Despite being quite thin as a young man, he was capable of generating remarkable power in his shots, though, as he aged, Jack would become a much more patient batsman, relying on his exceptional ability to thread the ball through any field to accumulate his runs. His career first-class record is nothing short of astonishing, passing 1,000 runs for the season 19 times between 1911 and 1934, and in four of those years he pushed on past the 2,000 mark for good measure. With 96 first-class centuries, 11 of them doubles under his belt, only war and illness preventing him passing 100. Young Jack Hearn sits in third place in the list of Middlesex's all-time run scorers, only bettered by his good friend Patsy Hendren and the much later batting talents of Mike Gatting. With the ball, J.W. Hearn was a genuine wicket-taking frontline bowler in his younger years and a steady enough, though often more expensive, part of the Middlesex attack by the end of his career. Coming in off only a few paces, young Jack would deliver his leg breaks and googlies with such a whip of the arm that they would come down at almost medium pace. He took over 100 wickets in a season five times, on each occasion completing the double with 1,000 runs, and in three of those years, the remarkable feat of 2,000 runs and 100 wickets. Jack would end his first-class career with 1,839 wickets, an average of 24. It is frustrating, then, that he never truly managed to display his skills at international level. Jack won his first cap in 1911 on England's tour of Australia, and although his bowling struggled on flat Australian wickets, he started promisingly with the bat, 76 and 46 in his first match, and a match winning 114 in the next. Unfortunately, that was to remain the peak of Jack's international career, and he would only pass 50 once more in England colours. In and out of the side until his final appearance in 1926, Jack's international figures pale in comparison with his county exploits. 24 tests, with a batting average of 26, and 30 wickets at a shade under 49. Walking to the wicket on this sultry morning, young Jack Hearn would have no doubt been aware that he was only 13 runs shy of achieving a 2,000-run, 100-wicket double for the season. To reach even that small number, however, he would need to be at his most watchful against Woolley and Blythe. With two master craftsman bowlers operating on a difficult pitch, Hearn, at first, looked somewhat shaky, with Tarrant appearing settled in comparison. Camped on the back foot, the batsman watched the ball warily, trying to meet it with the full face of the bat. Only when the bowler erred slightly would the ball be worked into the leg side for the occasional run. Scoring was slow, but soon Hearn called Tarrant through for his 13th run, and the season landmark was passed. That was as nearly good as it got for Jack Hearn, as having only scored six more runs, he played at a ball from Woolley and mistimed the shot straight to Arthur Fielder at mid-off. Fortune was on the Middlesex man's side that morning, and Fielder made a complete hash of what should have been a straightforward chance. The reprieve seemed to have a restorative effect on the batsman. From that moment, Hearn appeared to grow in confidence, and while runs would never flow freely, he found more balls to place to leg and kept the scoreboard ticking. The problems would be at the other end. While Hearn was finding his rhythm, Frank Tarrant remained cautious, allowing his partner to make most of the runs. Then, almost an hour into play, with the score on 44, Blythe, now bowling in tandem with Titch Freeman, snuck one past the bat of the Australian and sent him on his way, LBW for 16. If anything would settle the nerves of Middlesex supporters, it would have been the arrival of the considerable talent of Patsy Hendren at the wicket. Hendren, short but strong, who was destined to become a mammoth of the game, gave the impression of a man who could gather runs for fun, his scoring prowess ranking alongside Hobbs in the pantheon of the English game. On this morning, though, his normal superb timing eluded him, and Hendren struggled to get either of the bowlers away. At the other end, Hearn pushed on, hitting Freeman for a couple of threes, but Hendren could not settle against these bowlers on this pitch. Sensing the Middlesex man's discomfort, particularly to Blythe, Captain Kidd brought the field in close, and with Hendren on only five, the pressure almost paid off. Hendren's patience for digging in was being tested. He tried to take advantage of the field and use his power to crunch a delivery past point. He got hold of it, but placed the shot far too near to the close-in fielder, Edward Punter Humphreys, who went one-handed to the powerful low cut and spilled it. A tough chance, but the second one to go that morning, and seldom did people give Patsy Hendren two bites of the cherry without regretting it. Fortunately for Kent, the reprieve did not last long this time. The drop chance seemed to embolden Hendren, and despite the trickiness of the pitch and the quality of the bowling, he decided that attack was the way forward, and promptly lifted Blythe to long off, where George Whitehead took a well-judged catch. The powerhouse Hendren gone for five, Middlesex had lost three wickets for 67 runs, 46 of them from the bat of Hearn. It would appear that Jack Hearn was playing a different game from his county colleagues. He was watchful, but never let himself get tied down, using a combination of good footwork and expert placement to keep notching ones, twos and threes, often off good length balls. Boundaries were not going to be in great supply that day. His growing confidence on what should have been a bowler's morning clearly started to affect the Kent attack, who began regularly to release the pressure by serving Hearn with hittable balls. It was not so at the other end, however, as Jack Hearn's batting partners struggled to get a measure of the bowling or of the pitch. This was no collapse. Every partnership got started, but when it had edged itself into double figures, perhaps into the 20s, a wicket would fall and another Middlesex man was heading back into the pavilion. The contrast between Hearn and his colleagues was stark, standing out like a dreadnought surrounded by fishing boats, according to the Sporting Life. Soon after Hendren's departure, Jack Hearn reached his 50. With the dependable Nigel Haig now at the crease, Middlesex carefully pushed on for an hour and a half before, at close to 1:20, Haig was trapped in front by Freeman and departed for 13 with the score just six shy of three figures. The Middlesex 100 would be passed shortly, and when lunch was taken at 1:30, the score stood at 101 for four, Hearn on 65. Given the conditions and the bowling, the home side would have felt pleased with how they stood at lunch. A capital score, judged the correspondent from the Sportsman. That the home team had managed to eke out their century in the morning session was brought into sharp focus as darker clouds spread across St John's Wood and light rain fell during luncheon. From a batsman's point of view, the last thing this Lord's pitch needed was another sprinkling of water to give it more zip. The second session continued in the same vein as the first, a small, promising partnership followed by the fall of a wicket, with young Jack Hearn remaining unmoved. Left-hander Henry Weston looked to be positive, finding a rare boundary early on, but came perhaps too eager and was skilfully stumped, a beautiful act, according to the Sportsman, by Fred Hoish off Blythe. Captain Leslie Kidd joined Hearn to add another 23 runs to the score before he had his stumps rearranged by a delicious full-length woody delivery. The 150 was posted on the scoreboard before the pitch did for George Hebden, steering a spitting ball from Woolley into the hands of Lionel Troughton at close point. It was very nearly 2-2, but once again the Kent fielding let them down, and Titch Freeman dropped a straightforward chance from Stanley Saville at mid-off. Whichever way you look at it, Frank Edward Woolley was one of the most versatile cricketers to grace the game. He stands 28th on the list of all-time wicket takers, 2,066 wickets taken at an average of a shade under 20. Able to bowl left-arm medium or slow, he took a wicket, on average, every 45.9 balls, a better strike rate than, say, Locke, Laker or Underwood. While used sparingly with the ball in his later years, he still managed 100 wickets seasoned 8 times. As a fielder, his record is without peer. 1,018 first-class catches taken mostly at slip. No outfielder in the history of the game comes close. If you add wicket-keepers to the list, Woolley still stands 10th. A moment to savour that. In the history of first-class cricket, all but 9 wicket-keepers have failed to take more catches than the non-wicket-keeping Woolley. But it is with the bat that Frank Woolley will be remembered best. In a career that spanned 32 war-interrupted years and 978 matches, he scored 58,959 runs at an average of 40.77, including 145 centuries and a high score of 305 not out. Only Hobbs can boast a better career run aggregate. Woody passed 1,000 runs in a season a remarkable 28 times. In fact, only once, in his debut year of 1906, did a domestic season go by without Frank Woolley notching 1,000 runs. 2,000-run seasons came 12 times, and in 1928, 3,352 first-class runs were accumulated from Woolley's bat. In 64 test matches, he scored over 3,000 runs and took 83 wickets. A Tonbridge boy, he was spotted at the age of 12 by his later teammate Colin Blythe, who, discovering the child watching his net practice was a left-hander, invited Woolley into the nets. 7 years later, Frank would make his full Kent debut. It was an inauspicious start. Woody dropped a couple of simple catches and registered a first innings duck. He made somewhat of amends in his second innings with a brisk 64 and had earlier picked up a wicket, catching Albert Hornby off his own bowling, though neither contribution could prevent a comprehensive Lancashire victory. It did not take long, though, for Woolley's all-round talent to shine through, and he picked up his first five-wicket haul in his second match and registered a maiden century in his fourth. Kent and Woolley would never look back. Standing over 6 feet tall, Woolley used his long reach and good foot movement to great effect. Playing with the straightest of bats, he was not afraid to attack anything he saw as hittable, or, as Lord Hawke put it, Woolley was the most consistent exponent of the idea that the ball is there to be hit, and not patted or played with the pads. He could play all around the field, but his cover drives and cuts were the shots that seemed to stick most in his contemporaries' minds. For Pelham Warner, Woolley was simply one of the greatest cricketers the game has ever produced. Whether the remaining batsmen simply did not fancy their chances on this pitch, or instructions had come from the captain, the Middlesex men arrived at the crease looking to hit out in the fading light brought by increasingly ominous rain clouds. Stanley Saville, the 24-year-old right-hander who was known more for his international hockey exploits than his occasional appearances for Middlesex, bludgeoned Blythe for one boundary before skying another, which was safely pouched by Woolley moving in from cover. Both Joe Murrell and the other Hearn, JT, helped push the score towards and then over the 200 mark before both being relieved of their duties by Freeman. Middlesex were all out for a decent 205. Young Jack Hearn finished undefeated. It had taken him 3 hours and 25 minutes to reach his century, and he stood on 110 not out at the close of the innings. It was a remarkable innings in that, on an unpredictable pitch which had troubled all other batsmen, he had given only two chances, the drop on 19 and a difficult caught and bowled chance on 95. It had been a patient one too, with only 3-4 scored and 9-3s by his name in the scorebook. It is true that the Kent bowling had not been perfect. There were too many loose deliveries. But drizzling rain had meant the ball was often difficult to grip, and they had come across a man in impeccable nick. Hearn had scored over half of the runs accrued by his team, and no other batsman had managed more than Frank Tarrant's 16. Blythe had been the pick of the attack, taking 5 for 77 off 33 overs, and had shared the bulk of the work with Woolley, 2 for 77 off 24. Freeman took the other three wickets, though he had been the more expensive, conceding 42 from 11.5 overs. Colin Charlie Blythe, born in 1879 in Deptford to Walter, an engineer, and mother Elizabeth, had become one of English cricket's premier spin bowlers. Spotted by Captain Walter McCandless, then coaching young players at Kent, in the nets at Blackheath while his county were taking on Somerset in July of 1897, Blythe was invited to the Tonbridge nursery to try out his skills. The nursery was an impressive innovation by the Kent Committee, which established a centre where promising youngsters from around the county could come to be assessed, trained, and if good enough, propelled to the county proper. In Charlie Bligh's case, it did not take long. A year after he had first taken the eye of McCandless, Bligh bowled his first overs for Kent's second 11, and in August of 1898, he was introduced to the firsts. Not many present would forget Bligh's first 11 debut, as while his overall return was simply respectable, he managed to take a wicket with his very first ball. It was a decent scout too, Yorkshire's Frank Mitchell, who would make his international debut the following season. Bligh was a graceful, classical left-arm spin bowler. Upright in his delivery stride, he could deceive a batsman in the air with flight, loop and variation in pace, as well as beat them off the pitch with his turn. He was never afraid to pitch the ball up against an aggressive batsman, tempting them to drive his fizzing deliveries into a packed offside field. For Pelham Warner, Bligh was the very model of what a slow left-hand bowler should be. His first full season in 1900 saw him take 114 first-class wickets. In his second, he fell seven short of the 100-wicket mark, his form no doubt impacted by a combination of an illness suffered over the previous winter and a dry summer that robbed him of any sticky tracks on which to weave his magic. He would never again claim fewer than 100 victims in an English summer, and in 1909 bagged over 200. By the time war closed the 1914 season, he had taken an excess of 2,500 wickets at an average of 16.81, including an incredible 218 5-wicket innings and 71 10-wicket matches. Of all Bligh's notable performances, the one that particularly stood out was against Nottinghamshire in 1907, where he took all 10 wickets in the first innings, skittling them out for 60, and took another 7 in the follow-on. He finished the match with 17 wickets for 48 runs. With Bligh in the side, Kent were crowned county champions in 1906, 1909, 1910 and 1913. Without him, they would not win another until 1970. Bligh's international career was ultimately to be one of some frustration. Selected for Archie McLaren's 11 to tour Australia in 1901-2, Charlie had a respectable series with the ball, but would need to wait until 1905 before his first taste of a home test, an Ashes contest at Leeds. Over the next 5 years, he would come and go from the international team. The Headingley Test was his only one of 1905, but he was selected for all the fixtures against South Africa, away and then home, in 1906 and 1907. Picked for the Ashes tour in 1907-8, he was only to feature in the opening test at Sydney. While his international career would last until 1910, his appearances for country would only be occasional. It was a truncated England career, but a decent one. In 19 tests, he had taken exactly 100 wickets at an average of 18.63, with a best bowling return of 8 for 59, taking at Headingley against South Africa. The reasons for his spotty appearance record for his country were varied and disputed. At certain points in Bligh's career, especially in the early years, his difficulty in securing a regular England place was down to the fact that he operated at a time when another quality slow left-arm bowler, one Wilfred Rhodes, was also available to the selection panel. Bligh also suffered from health issues which appeared to be exacerbated by the pressures of international cricket. The exact nature of these issues is not clear. At times there have been mentions of epilepsy, though the evidence for that is not obvious. But whatever the condition, he found his international career disturbed. In 1909, he missed the Lord's Test against Australia after a doctor he had consulted at the wishes of the Kent Committee advised against his selection. When the match went badly, and the England selectors were facing criticism over their decisions, they took the extraordinary decision to release Bligh's medical report to the press, which outlined the strain on Bligh's nervous system caused by playing in a test match that lasts for a week afterwards. His biographer and relative, John Bligh Smart, has also suggested that conflict between Bligh and C.B. Fry may have also played a part in his omission from England's sides in the years before the outbreak of war. The Kent openers, Hunter Humphreys and Wally Hardinge, had little reason to be optimistic that the pitch would be kinder to them than their opponents. However, the effects of the heavy roller might temporarily becalm the surface. The light was improving, and at least they would not have to face the wiles of Charlie Blythe. Middlesex's opening bowling partnership of Tarrant and J.T. Hearn, however, were experienced adversaries, and the batsmen would need to play a vigilant game. Neither bowled of express pace, though Hearn had the ability to push it through a little faster than his Australian colleague when required. But the combination of Tarrant's accurate left-arm slow-medium and Hearn's quicker off-breaks would be enough of a challenge on a drying pitch. Wally Hardinge led the way, batting with his usual style, athletic, patient, and with a watchful eye. Unfortunately, few of his Kent teammates seemed inclined to follow his lead. Whether an end-of-term atmosphere had descended on the changing room, or Hardinge's colleagues had decided that they were unlikely to survive too long on that pitch and so needed to make some quick runs, the modus operandi appeared to be to hit out. The result was perhaps inevitable, and Hardinge had only 3 runs to his name by the time that 2 of his partners had been sent on their way. Humphreys, who had a reputation as a strong back foot player who was good against the turning ball, was LBW to J.T. Hearn, and James Seymour found himself caught in the deep off the same bowler when he decided to try and launch the ball into the crowd. While earlier in the day, Middlesex may have got away with a few loose strokes through errant Kentish fielding, the home team were in no mood to return the favour, and every catch that went to hand stuck. The sight of the formidable Frank Woolley striding to the crease would have given Hardinge more hope that the tumble of wickets would cease, and he began to grow in confidence. Still remaining watchful, but powerfully dismissing anything loose to the boundary. The partnership for the 3rd wicket passed 20, with Hardinge very much the dominant partner. Yet, with the score on 35, it was Woolley's patience that snapped, and he belted a ball from Frank Tarrant high into the outfield, where it was pouched by the large, safe hands of Patsy Hendren. Another one gone. Another stylish batsman in the Kent ranks, Sam Day, did not hang around for long, adding only a couple to the score before being trapped in front by J.T. Hearn. Sensing his supply of capable partners was diminishing, Hardinge became more aggressive, regularly hitting through the field to the boundary. Better support was found at the other end, first from George Whitehead, and when he had been cleaned up by J.T. Hearn, from his captain Lionel Troughton. It was with the latter at the other end that Hardinge raised his bat for a hard-won half-century. Comparisons between Hardinge's efforts and those of J.W. Hearn were obvious. The Middlesex man's play was more about placement, the Kent openers based on power, but both held steady in difficult batting conditions while wickets fell at the other end. Eventually, it was the power of Hardinge's strokes that was his undoing, and cutting a ball from Tarrant too close to young Jack Hearn at point, he was on his way. His 58 had taken over an hour and a half, and 6 fours and, thanks to an overthrow, 1 5, he had left the field with the score on 91 for 6. None of the colleagues who had preceded him into the pavilion had managed more than 6. Lionel Troughton, still out in the middle, had managed to make it into double figures, but before another run could be added to the total, he was quickly back in the hutch as well, unwisely lifting J.T. Hearn into the deep, straight to the waiting hands of Nigel Haig. When the first day's play came to an end, Kent had been batting for less than 2 hours, and were in all sorts of trouble at 96 for 7. Hoish and Blythe, the not-out batsmen. Friday the 28th of August, 1914. Day 2. The players awoke the next morning to a much brighter day. The clouds had mostly lifted, the sun was poking through, and the temperature promised to remain pleasant. If the drier conditions could take some of the devil out of the pitch, there was a prospect of a better day for batting. Kent were to resume the day, still 109 runs behind the home side, and needed unlikely heroics from Hoish, Blythe, Freeman and Fielder if they were not going to concede a potentially unsurmountable deficit. Play began at 11 in front of a growing crowd. The chance to catch a day of the last 1914 county championship match at Lord's was being taken by a good number, and about 3,000 people would take their places by the end of the day. It was clear from the start that the surface had settled down somewhat, and it was a lick quicker than on the first day, though still one to navigate with some caution while any morning dew evaporated. Frank Tarrant and J.T. Hearn, who had bowled unchanged the previous evening, were to resume their duties. The Kent tail-enders had clearly decided to approach their task with a positive intent. No use hanging around waiting to be knocked over, perhaps. The predictable outcome was that runs came quickly, but wickets fell that way too. A rapid 11 runs were added by the Kent numbers 8 and 9 before Fred Hoish had his stumps rearranged by J.T. Hearn, and one run later, Blythe followed in an identical fashion. It fell to Frank Tarrant to finish the job, and 20 minutes into the day's play, he bowled Titch Freeman to bring Kent's innings to a close with only 116 on the board. Middlesex led by 89, and their hopes of a late challenge for the championship remained on course. Tarrant and J.T. Hearn had bowled just shy of 55 overs between them and had been an exceptional partnership. Hearn had the greater success, taking 7 of the wickets to fall, conceding 65 runs. Tarrant was the more economical, picking up his 3 wickets at the cost of only 47. While J.T. Hearn could go and put his feet up for a long rest, Frank Tarrant needed to hurry back to the pavilion and get his pads on to open the innings once more. Kent's skipper, Lionel Troughton, had been alert to a slight change in the conditions of the pitch and knew that, with a draw unlikely, if Kent were to turn this around, quick wickets were key. Accordingly, while his main wicket-taker from the first innings, Blythe, would have the second over, Troughton threw the new ball to Arthur Fielder. Fielder was a fast bowler in the modern style, who would maintain a consistent line outside of off stump, swing the ball away and hope to tempt the drive and bring the slips into play. He had the ability to break the ball back in towards the right-handed batsman, but would mostly hammer away with his outswingers. The fact that his captain had entrusted him with the first over rather than Woolley was an indication of how conditions had begun to change. With the dampness all but gone, the pitch had regained much of its firmness and with it a yard of pace, something which Fielder, who was genuinely quick, should be able to exploit. And so, at 12:20, and with the sun beating down on his back, Fielder tore in from the pavilion end to try and turn the match around for the visitors. Given how many of their batsmen had struggled in the first innings, it was clear that Kent would have to get on top quickly and try not to leave themselves too many to chase. Fielder and Blythe started well enough, and after an errant ball apiece were dispatched for fours, the bowlers began to make life difficult for the Middlesex openers. A streaky boundary for Tarrant off Fielder seemed to awaken the Australian, and he looked to go after the fast bowler, scoring quickly enough to prompt Captain Troughton to signal to Titch Freeman to come on for a bowl. By the half-hour mark, though batting was still by no means easy, runs had come at 1 a minute, mostly off the bat of Frank Tarrant. As in the first innings, though, it will be the skilful Blythe who struck first. Harry Lee had been having more problems getting the score moving along than his partner, and with only 9 to his name, Lee played back to a quicker one from the Kent spinner, which sped past the bat and crashed into his stumps. 35 for 1. Time for the hero of the first innings, young Jack Hearn. The next hour or so was going to be the most crucial of the match. If young Jack and Frank Tarrant stayed together, with Hendren in at 4 to add further power, the match could easily be taken completely from Kent's reach. If, however, Blythe, Freeman and Woolley could knock over the middle order cheaply, the game would be very much alive. Initially, it appeared that it was to be the home team that would have their way. Tarrant continued in a positive vein, and Hearn certainly took a liking to Freeman, crashing an overpitched ball to the boundary early on, and then hanging back for the cut to bring up the Middlesex 50. A lead of 139 that, with only one wicket down, was threatening to become insurmountable. Freeman had been put under pressure, but it was the diminutive leg-break bowler who would bring the game back to life. The score had reached 64 when Titch managed to sneak one past the bat of Frank Tarrant and send him on his way, LBW. Out strode Patsy Hendren, who took guard and promptly edged his first ball from Freeman to Woolley at second slip. 64 for 3, Freeman on a hat-trick. Alfred Percy Freeman, Titch, due to his 5 feet 2 inches of height, was in his debut season in first-class cricket. This was his 7th match for Kent, and in the previous 6 he had only given hints of what was to become a magnificent spin bowling career. Born into a cricket-connected family, his father was a groundsman at Streatham, his brother John played for Essex. Titch came to Kent in 1912 at the age of 24, after a spell at Essex Club and Ground. In 1913, he took 125 wickets for Kent's second 11, prompting his county to give him his full debut the following season. War robbed the young spinner of some of his best cricketing years, but on county cricket's return, Titch, then 31, made up for lost time. Only 60 first-class wickets came in 1919, but thereafter, not a season would go by before his retirement from county cricket in 1936, aged 48, without over 100 wickets being in the bag. Coming in off a short run, Titch would deliver his leg breaks, googlies and top spinners with unerring accuracy. While he could turn the ball at will, it was his control of flight and variations in speed that did for many a batsman, often foxed by what had looked like a playable delivery. Such was his ability to beat a batsman in flight that stumped Ames or stumped Hubble, bowled Freeman, was a regular note in Kent's scorecards. Stumpings accounted for almost 13% of his first-class wickets. Happy to bowl for long periods without tiring, Titch was a captain's dream. A run of consecutive English seasons with the wickets column registering in the hundreds was broken in spectacular fashion in the dry summer of 1928 when Titch Freeman took 304 first-class scalps, a truly astonishing feat that had never been achieved before and probably will never be again. Every season from 1929 to 1935 saw Titch take in excess of 200 first-class wickets and notched up the rarest of all bowling feats, all 10 wickets in an innings, in 3 consecutive years, 1929, 1930 and 1931. Add to that 3 hat-tricks and a final career tally of 3,776 first-class wickets that stands above all, except the great Wilfred Rhodes, in history's bowling annals. The only aspect of Titch's career that did not hit such heights was his Test career. Perhaps because he played most of his international matches on overseas tours with unfamiliar wickets, he struggled to replicate his county form when wearing England or MCC colours. Whatever the reason, 12 matches gave him 66 Test wickets at an average of over 25. For a lesser bowler, it may have seemed a respectable return. For Freeman, it looked like a curious anomaly. Named one of the Wisden Cricketers of the Year in 1923, Titch became an honorary life member of the MCC in 1949. It would not be 3-3 for Freeman this time at Lord's, but Kent's tails were up, and only 8 runs later, Woody got in on the act, pinning young Jack Hearn LBW. At 72 for 4, with the lead standing on 161, Kent was still in the hunt, but needed to keep the pressure on the home team. However, it would now be Middlesex's turn to apply the pressure. Rather than dig in until lunch to stem the fall of wickets, Nigel Haig and Henry Weston decided to counter-attack. Both batsmen went after any delivery that was pitched up, launching drive after drive, first off Freeman and Woolley, and then off Blythe and Fielder. In the half hour before lunch, the pair had added a valuable 51 to the score, pushing the lead over 200 by the time the break came. While they enjoyed their Lord's luncheon, Middlesex would have been aware that their work was not yet done. It was true that Kent had made only 116 in their first innings, but this had become a different surface. On day one, it had been a damp spinner's pitch. Now the sun had done its work. It was on its way to being a batsman's. As so often happens, lunch can bring a change in fortunes. Batsmen's concentration can be interrupted, Full stomachs can dull the sharpness of the eye. Bowlers enjoy a brief rest for their weary bones and take time to rethink their lines of attack. Or perhaps sometimes Lady Luck just takes the opportunity to change sides. Whatever the forces at work, the lunch break did the trick for Kent, and it was not long before both batsmen were back in the hutch. Only five extras had been added to the lunchtime score when Haig was trapped in front by Freeman, and seven runs after that, Weston was comprehensively beaten by the same man, bowled while trying to hit out. 135 for six, a lead of 224. A quick clean-up of the tail would have left the game in the balance, perhaps even slightly in Kent's favour on a rapidly improving surface. However, at that moment, in strode George Hebden, who was to prove a thorn in the visitors' sides and tilt the odds firmly towards Middlesex. Hebden had been an occasional player for Middlesex since his debut in 1908, and it had taken until the 1914 season before he managed to post his first century, 101 in a victory against Lancashire in mid-August. He could never be described as the most classically styled batsman, but he was resourceful and could latch on to the bad ball with power and good timing. In the second innings against Kent, he took a little time to settle into his innings, but once his eye was in, Hebden took about the bowling. Chiefly relying on drives and hits to square leg, he made sure the score pushed quickly upwards in tandem with first, Leslie Kidd, LBW Bligh for 21, the partnership were 57, then Stanley Saville, neatly stumped by Hoich off Freeman for 10, 22 runs having been added, and finally alongside Joe Murrell. Having raised his bat for a valuable half-century, Hebden finally gave way for 58, edging behind a ball from Arthur Fielder that had leapt off the surface. His efforts had seen the score rise to 240 for 9, giving the home side a now formidable lead of 329. If the match had begun to slip away from Kent via the bat of Hebden, things were to get even worse with the arrival of old Jack Hearn at the crease. Even at his peak at the end of the late 19th century, he could make no great claim to prowess with the bat, a career first-class average of 11.98 being testament to that. And now, with Jack at the age of 47, the Kent openers would have been forgiven for thinking that their time to pad up would soon be on them. Jack, though, was not about to go anywhere. He equally had no intention of scoring any runs, and took to steadfastly blocking every delivery that came his way. The tactic proved extremely effective, and by the time Joe Morrell was bowled by Frank Woolley, the pair had added another 36 runs to the total. J.T. Hearn's contribution? A deceptively valuable naught. Kent had every reason to be disappointed. At 135 for six, they had been truly in the hunt, but even with the talents of Blythe, Woolley, Freeman and Fielder at their disposal, had been unable to kill the innings off. Freeman emerged with the pick of the figures, having taken 5 for 87, but a combination of forceful batting from Hebden and Murrell, stubborn resistance from J.T. Hearn, and some lacklustre Kent fielding had allowed the Middlesex tail to help set a formidable total of 366 for Kent to chase for victory. Formidable, yet not totally impossible. It was true that, if Kent were to pull off a handsome victory, it would mean making by far the largest score of the game. However, the pitch would be in a more batsman-friendly condition at the start of their innings than at any time previously in the match. It would also mean setting a Lords County Championship record. On only three previous occasions had teams chased down over 300 runs to win a county match on the ground. Middlesex in 1900, Somerset in 1902, and Yorkshire in 1910. And with Yorkshire's 331 standing as the highest chase, no county had ever made over 350 in a successful run chase. If Kent were to have looked for historical encouragement, they would have found it in representative matches at Lords, where a winning score in excess of 400 had been posted four times. Even so, the odds were firmly with the home side, and Kent would need a strong performance from their top-order batsmen to even get close. Leslie Kidd may have only been Middlesex's acting captain, but he had some wiles about him, and as Trout had done when Kent were in the field for the second time, he decided to respond to the changing conditions and make a switch in his opening bowling partnership. With the pitch now offering far less off the surface, Kidd clearly decided to try and beat the batsman in the air and turned to Nigel Haig's fast-medium swingers, Frank Tarrant, to come in from the other end. It was an inspired choice, and the 26-year-old Etonian amateur caused Kent problems from the start. In the first over, Wally Hardinge nudged a single, leaving punter Humphreys to face Haig. The contest did not last long, as before either the over was finished or Humphreys had troubled the scorer, he was making the long walk back to the pavilion, having edged Haig to the safe hands of Patsy Hendren at slip. 1-1. Things were not going to get any better for Kent soon. Haig's tail was up, and 6 runs and a bye later, he had another scalp. Hardinge. Kent's top scorer last time around was bowled by one that kept low. Out for 4. 8-2. Kent's formidable task was starting to look an impossibility. Yet, if there was a chink of light, it was in the form of Frank Woolley making his way to the wicket. If there was any way out of this muddle for the visiting team, they would need every ounce of Woolley's undisputed talent. They would also need others to give him support, and that was where the immediate problem lay. Before Woolley could even open his account, James Seymour was gone, brilliantly stumped by Hoish off Tarrant. He was still scoreless when Sam Day came and went, caught Hendren, bowled Haig for a solitary run. Woolley and George Whitehead managed to put on 4 runs between them, but could manage no more before the latter was on his way as Haig's 4 flicked him, this time caught behind. Only 30 minutes had been played of Kent's second innings, and the score stood at 13-5. The victory target of 366, a pinprick in the distance. It was time for the captain to stop the rot, and, in Lionel Troughton, Woolley finally found the support he needed to truly show what he was made of. The Kent left-hander quickly made the game look very easy, with effortless sweeps to square leg and flashing drives to both on and off sides. Troughton knew that his job was to simply hold up his end and let Woolley score the runs. After 30 minutes of the Woolley-Troughton partnership, Kidd rotated his bowlers, firstly bringing on J.W. Hearn for Haig, and shortly after J.T. Hearn for Tarrant. Within 15 minutes, the change had done the trick. It was old Jack, J.T. Hearn, who made the breakthrough, and taking not just a wicket, but the wicket, Woolley, bowled for 40. With the score on 67-6, and Woolley gone, the game was as good as over. For the remaining 4 batsmen to muster another 299 runs was beyond hope. Any Kent supporters at Lord's could, though, have expected slightly more fight than the debacle which then unfurled before them. Before J.T. Hearn's first over was finished, another batsman was on his way, Fred Hoish, LBW, for a duck. J.W. Hearn ran in to begin the next over and soon got in on the fun, trapping Troughton in front before he had managed to add further to the 12 runs he'd put on with Woolley. It was nearly 2-2 when Titch Freeman immediately offered a chance to mid-off, but it was not taken. It did not matter, as the very next ball, Hearn snuck one past bat and pad and onto the wicket. 9 wickets down, and with the match all but over, Kent's number 11 batsman, Arthur Fielder, clearly wasn't going to make people stay around for too long. Receiving his first ball, Fielder attempted to launch J.W. Hearn out of the ground, made contact only with fresh air, leaving Joe Murrell to complete a straightforward stumping. 1 hour and 25 minutes after Humphreys and Hardinge had begun the innings, Kent were all out for a pitiful 67, having not managed to add a single run after Woolley was dismissed at 6 down. The sudden nature of the late order collapse was indicated by the 2 Hearns' second innings returns, J.T. taking 2-3 off 2 overs, giving him 9 wickets in the match. J.W. finished with 3 wickets for 6 runs. Handshakes were exchanged, and while Kent was still due a trip to Bournemouth to face Hampshire in their last fixture of 1914, Middlesex were finished for the season. They cannot have known that the next time their county caps would be pulled on for a competitive fixture would be over 4.5 years hence. As for the present, they had done their bit to ensure their championship hopes remained alive, and could only now watch and hope that Surrey would stumble in their final three matches. They didn't. The first against Gloucestershire, Surrey won by an innings, thanks to centuries from Hobbs and Knight. And when the final two fixtures were called off, bringing a premature end to the season, Surrey claimed the title. As for Kent, they had another fixture to fulfil, and although they were missing the services of Colin Blythe, Arthur Fielder and George Whitehead, they managed to put out a competitive side by welcoming back the experience of Jack Hubbell and Bill Fairservice, while handing a debut to left-arm bowler William Hickmott. When the season eventually drew to its premature close, the cricketers of the 1914 season went their various ways, most to service in some form. Not all of those who represented Middlesex or Kent in their last meeting for 5 years went into the armed services. Fred Hoish and J.T. Hearn were too old to enlist, and so were not required to serve. Though Hearn, despite being over 50 by the time of the cessation of hostilities, would return to first-class cricket after the war. The Australian, Frank Tarrant, had perhaps the most unusual of journeys during the war years, when he took up an offer to play cricket in India under the Maharaja of Cooch Behar, among others. Tarrant played for many years after the war, but it was for the Europeans and Palatia in Indian cricket, rather than Middlesex. Once achieving the remarkable feat of taking all 10 wickets in an innings and scoring a century in the same match, he remained in the game as an umpire after retiring from playing. Titch Freeman, well within the age limit for overseas service, but under the required height, instead volunteered for home service as a special constable. James Seymour, with a family and a motor business to run, joined him. Arthur Fielder, who was 37 and on the cusp of the upper age limit for the regular army, also volunteered at home as an auxiliary policeman with the Kent Constabulary. The Kent Committee were keen to see their men take to arms, and those professionals of serviceable age who were still in civilian clothes by early 1915 received a letter asking why that was the case and offering to make up any shortfall in their wages caused by joining the services. Among those in receipt of this missive were Woolley, Hardinge and Humphreys. Each had their reason for not having taken up arms. Woolley had recently married, and Hardinge and Humphreys both had other family members reliant on their support. But the pressure from their county worked, and all three volunteered. Woolley was initially rejected on medical grounds, compacted toes, but was eventually accepted into the Royal Naval Air Service, put into service helping rescue downed airmen from a base in Felixstowe, Kent, before being transferred to North Queensferry in Scotland. Hardinge also spent most of the war on home shores, again with the RNAS. Humphreys took a different route and signed up to the Royal Navy, with whom he served in the Dover Patrol. Pressure to enlist from within the county was not a preserve of Kent. Middlesex's Harry Lee recounted the circumstances which led to his call to arms. When war was announced and the drift of cricketers exchanging whites for military uniforms began, Lee was uninterested, viewing the war as nothing to do with him, his only interest being his burgeoning career as a cricketer. It was the grand figure of Pelham Warner that began his change of heart. As county colleagues, their paths inevitably crossed at Lord's, where Warner cast a paternal eye over the junior professional. "Well, young Lee," began the county captain, "you look as though you'd make a fine soldier." Well, Harry indicated that he didn't entirely agree with this assessment. "Aren't you going to join up?" inquired a surprised Warner. Harry said he wasn't thinking of it, prompting his captain to leave with a parting, concerned, Standing nearby, listening to this exchange, was Harry's friend, the Middlesex wicketkeeper Joe Murrell, who upbraided him for answering back to Warner in that way. When Harry asked why, Murrell explained, "Well, you know, everyone will be joining up, and you won't get much of a show around Lord's if you don't." Harry Lee signed up the next day. Middlesex's Patsy Hendren was one who was fortunate to avoid facing the guns on the front line, despite signing up before Christmas of 1914, when he was placed in the 1st Sportsman's Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers. A form of PALS battalion, Patsy was grouped with other sportsmen, including the lightweight boxing champion of England, Jerry Delaney, and fellow England cricketer Andrew Sandham. The unit saw action during the Battle of the Somme. Delaney was one to lose his life there, but Patsy did not travel with them. Instead, after initial training, he was transferred to the reserve depot at Leamington Spa, where he would see out the remainder of the war. His brother, John, was not so lucky, and lost his life in the Battle of Delville Wood, the same action that had killed Delaney. At least three of the Middlesex 11 from their last fixture of 1914 did face action in France and managed to return home physically intact. Young Jack Hearn was with the London Regiment, Stanley Saville fought with the 2nd Essex Regiment, and Nigel Haig earned the Military Cross for his service with the Royal Field Artillery. Others were not so fortunate as to return in good physical shape. Kent's captain, Lionel Troughton, rose quickly through the ranks of the Royal Fusiliers to Lieutenant Colonel, where he led with great courage. In charge of a company in the Battle of the Somme, Troughton led from the front even in the face of intense enemy fire. For his gallantry, he was awarded the Military Cross. In November of 1917, however, Troughton was captured by German forces and saw out the remainder of the conflict in a prisoner of war camp. Eventually repatriated, he was discharged in 1919 on grounds of his physical condition. Middlesex's George Hebden was quick to sign up for duty following the close of the season, and was already in France by the end of 1914. Serving in the Royal Flying Corps, he was injured in action, but recovered sufficiently to play one final match for Middlesex in the 1919 season. War appeared to have taken the life of one of Middlesex's opening batsmen. Less than a month after scoring his maiden century at Lord's, Harry Lee found himself facing an even greater challenge when he signed up for military service with the 13th County of London Battalion, the Kensingtons. By February of 1915, he was in France. By March, he had seen action, and in May, his battalion took heavy casualties during the Battle of Auberge Ridge. Harry was among them. Shot in the leg, he lay injured in no man's land for 3 days before being captured by the Germans. The news that reached England was that he was missing, presumed dead, and a memorial service was held in his honour. Thankfully, while hurt, Harry was alive. He slowly recovered and was returned to England in October of the same year, after exaggerating the extent of his injury to the German authorities. On his return home, Lee was greeted with the news that the damage to his leg was such that he would be granted an honourable discharge from the army, and that it was unlikely he would ever play cricket again. Once again, Harry defied the odds, and with treatment paid for by Middlesex, and a spell playing and coaching alongside his old friend Frank Tarrant in India, he returned to county colours. All of those who were wounded in action made sufficient recovery to play first-class cricket again. But for six of the men who took the field at Lord's for the home of cricket's last county match of the season, it was for the last time. In the case of Frank Tarrant, Fred Hoish, and Arthur Fielder, their careers, interrupted by war, came to a peaceful end. Tarrant was enjoying his cricket in India. Hoish and Fielder were aged over 40. The occasional Middlesex amateur Henry Weston also made his last county appearance in the game at Lord's. His fate, though, is somewhat unclear. There have been suggestions that he lost his life while serving in the war, but the evidence to support this remains elusive. For two of the Kent side which succumbed to Middlesex at Lord's, their fate became well known. George Whitehead, having served in the College Engineer Corps while at Clifton, soon applied to the Royal Military Academy and passed the entrance exam with flying colours. The early months of 1915 were spent in training, but by September, Lieutenant George Whitehead found himself in action at the Battle of Loos with the Royal Field Artillery. Although seeing a great deal of action on the front, George avoided physical injury until appendicitis brought him down, and he spent most of 1917 at home. By 1918, he returned to active service, but this time as a pilot with the Royal Flying Corps, to whom he had applied during his convalescence. There was a tragic irony in that George saw the transfer from trenches to the air as one that would bring greater safety. The danger of spills, he wrote, is almost always due to overconfidence and carelessness, which is a very good reason why I shouldn't come to grief. Can you ever remember me trying to hit just because I'd made 50, or because I had hit a couple of fours, unless there was no need for my side to make runs? Well, I don't see myself doing unnecessary stunts. His last day began as one of celebration. On the morning of October the 17th, 1918, George Whitehead and fellow Lieutenant Reginald Griffiths flew low over Lowther in Belgium. They were on patrol, looking for German artillery. As they passed over the town, George raised himself up in the cockpit and waved a flag to the people below, who greeted them with great cheers. They made several passes over Lowther, much to the delight of the local population. Still flying low, they made their way out towards the nearby railway station when their plane was peppered by bullets from a German machine gun. Both men were hit, and by the time their crashed plane was reached by Belgian services, Lieutenants Griffiths and Whitehead were dead. Both were buried in the military cemetery the next day. Kent and England's Colin Blythe was one of the first to answer the call of duty, along with his friends and fellow Kent nursery graduates David Jennings, Henry Preston and Claude Woolley, brother of Frank, and who played for Gloucestershire and Northamptonshire. Joined by David's brother Thomas, who had gone to play for Surrey, they were photographed as they enlisted together for the Kent Fortress Engineers. For almost the first 3 years of the war, Colin Blythe was stationed close to home at Gillingham. In September of 1917, however, both Blythe and Claude Woolley found themselves on the way to Belgium, having been transferred to the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, where they would be put to work laying and maintaining railway lines through Ypres. On November the 8th, during the Third Battle of Ypres, a shell landed close to their unit while they were carrying out work on the line between Wiltshire and Gravenstafel. Woolley was injured. Blythe was dead. Whitehead and Blythe were far from alone, of course. As far as can be told, 245 men with test or first-class cricket experience lost their lives in that conflict. Many more returned injured, both physically and mentally. Cricket would resume once more, albeit after an extended hiatus. For many of the young men of the cricketing field, up and down the country, in counties, in towns, in villages, however, that late summer of 1914 would be their last.
The long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to
Thank you for listening to Cricket in England through five matches. Henry Newbolt's Vitae Lampada was read by Owen Oakeshott. It's a Long Way to Tipperary was sung by John McCormack. In our next episode, we will visit Edgbaston in 1924 for England against South Africa and the story of England and English cricket's recovery from the war. Cricket in England through five matches is a production of Cricket Stuff. Find us at cricketstuff.blog or on Twitter at cricket_stuff.